Ryan Stanton here with ASAP Frontline, joined finally by one of the folks I've been following ever since I was an emergency physician over the last number of years. Actually, I figured out that this is my 12th scientific assembly in a row, and I think I've probably every possible one I could have attended that you guys have done. We've done it when we're not sitting here recording. I'm joined today by Dr. Richard Picotta. Doesn't need any further real introduction than that when it comes to incredibly popular sessions with himself and Dr. Hoffman. But you're going to talk to us today about something usually you guys are associated with the literature reviews, but you've got physician performance and other things you want to talk about with us.
So Jerry's going to do his thing about the literature, and I saw that, and I said, well, I don't want to do that too. So the Canadian Journal of Emergency Medicine has a kind of a debate series,
mm-hmm.
and I was asked to do part of a debate about the value of physician performance measurement. And on the other side of the debate was, come on, leave us alone, give us the proper support we need, and we'll do fine. And obviously, if you want to win a popularity contest, you're going to take the point of view, well, leave us alone, and so give us the support we need, and everybody will be fine. But in the process of reviewing the literature, it's pretty clear to me that physicians need to have their work looked at. And I know that that is not a popular concept, the idea that doctors are going to have their work scrutinized, especially if they're non-doctors, but that's not something that we kind of are fond with at all. Yet, when I started looking at the literature about, well, you know what would we find out by looking at the physician performance, and I saw a number of examples, and it was really clear that we cannot manage what we can't measure. That's Peter Drucker, the management guru, said that. But so I started looking at some things, like, as an example, there was a study that looked at the Pekarne hospitals. You know, there's mm-hmm. about 25 hospitals that do all these studies, and they put together this criteria, which have been compared with a whole bunch of other criteria, and the Pekarne apparently are the best. And there's a study done at these 25 Pekarne hospitals about the use of CT for mild blunt head trauma in kids. And at one end of the spectrum, CTs were done in 20% of the kids with mild head trauma at one hospital. And another hospital, they did 70% of the kids got a CT scan. And these are the hospitals that came up with the criteria. And one hospital is at 20%, the other hospital is at 70%. And can you imagine if they had looked at individual physician performance, it would have been all over the dartboard. And one of the highlights of this study was in the kids that don't need a CT, Pekarne negative, 13% of the kids got CTs. In the hospitals that came up with the criteria, in the hospitals that are to academic teaching hospitals, and it was like, well, if these guys are out there all over the dartboard, what would happen if we would just measure everybody? And the reason to measure is because patients deserve it. Patients deserve the best care we can give them, evidence-based care. And I saw one example after the other about variation, which is so marked that it's like we have to identify it, and we got to really see if we can narrow their variability so that our patients really can get the best testing, the best outcomes, the most cost-effective care, the most evidence-based care. And you just can't assume that the experts are delivering it.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's absolutely the case. And the challenge, and you even hit on the challenge at the beginning, is the fact that so many physicians, you know, we feel like we've gone through this road very much alone, you know, going through medical school, residency, and our practice. Now folks coming in and saying, we want to monitor and see how you do it. And of course, automatically, we're thinking about things like Prescani and stuff where we're trying to quantify things that aren't necessarily quality or quantifiable measures. And the resistance for that feedback and the lack and the challenge of acceptance of input on improvement with a physician is a challenge.
Absolutely. It's we haven't had our practices challenged since maybe we were a resident. And you get out there and people are not going to be kind of looking at, well, I think Joe orders a lot more tests than I do, but, you know, who am I to say kind of thing? And but the fact of the matter is somebody's paying for all of Joe's tests, and Joe never met a test that he didn't like, and there's all of this downstream stuff. When you start ordering tests, you start finding incidental findings, mm-hmm. and that leads to another kind of test. Let me give you one more example. The most important decisions that we make tend to be admissions expensive decision that you've made. So here's a study that I saw, University of Utah, 2069 pneumonia cases, and they looked at the individual physicians on the faculty. These are not residents. These are faculty doctors. One doctor admitted 38% of their pneumonia patients. Another doctor admitted 79% of their pneumonia patients, and there was no difference in severity or outcome.
Mm-hmm.
One doctor is admitting twice the number of pneumonia cases. In the preamble of the paper, it said an inpatient treatment of pneumonia is 25 times more expensive than an outpatient treatment. And it's like, did anybody really ever pay attention to this? Physicians can, I believe, learn from others. Well, Joe, how do you get your patients through the department as quickly as you do? I didn't realize that I was on the outlier on the bell-shaped curve of the CTs. Maybe just when you show them the data, doctors don't want to be outliers. The curve will narrow just by showing them the data. But you have to get the data, and the data needs to be clean. And the first thing the doctors are going to say is, well, it's got this problem or that problem, so that you have to try to make the data as unassailable as possible. But there will always be limitations to data. Just like in any clinical study, there's some limitations. But I think that to practice responsibly in a group, whether you're in a single hospital or you're in a large, you know, group, they got to measure. This is we're over $10,000 a patient right now, a person in the United States a year. Canada is in the sixes, similar if not better outcomes. It's like, yeah, there may be other factors than this healthcare system, but, you know, we just never met a CAT scan we didn't love.
How much of it is fear? Because the doctors I've seen that have the huge admission rates, have the huge testing rates, they have a fear of either one missing something, or a fear of medical legal risk. They've been sued, and so they've got that fear involved.
Well, you know, I think that this idea that I'm afraid of being sued is just a kind of like a cop-out, because the fact of the matter is that lawsuits have dropped like a stone, and it is much harder to get sued now than it ever was. And so I think that to say I'm afraid of being sued, in the old days, it was believed that the rate of lawsuits was somewhere in the neighbor of 1 in 20,000 to 1 in 30,000 patients would generate a lawsuit. But now, you know, it's getting much harder to sue doctors. They have all of these states that have caps on pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. California's had a cap on pain and suffering for, I bet you, 25 years, and that cap is $250,000. It has not moved up with inflation. You can't buy anything in California for $250,000. And people said, well, at least tag it to inflation. So there's no incentive to, except if you're going to get a big dollar case, like, you know, somebody gets paralyzed and they need care for the rest of their life. But, you know, the facts are that lawsuits have really, really dropped. But people say, well, I'm still being, you know, it's just a knee-jerk response. They've probably never been sued. Yeah, I think the doctors that have been sued, they've gotten burned, and I think that the damage is done. Most people are probably not going to be, they are going to be, just as you said, they're going to have a low threshold for admission, a lot of tests, but I think the vast majority of physicians have not been sued, and the likelihood is, you know, you might get one claim in or two claims in your career, and, you know, we buy insurance to protect ourselves. We buy car insurance to protect ourselves. That's what you're paying the premium for. It's not about kind of like you're a bad doctor kind of thing. It was a mistake. Maybe it was a legitimate mistake. Maybe it wasn't. But the fact of the matter is we cannot keep on falling back on the excuse of, well, I'm afraid of getting sued, or I'm afraid of missing things. We cannot go to the point where we are zero misses for MI, zero misses for PE, zero misses for appendicitis, because we're going to a lot more people in the process of doing CT pulmonary angiograms on people who don't need it and going down that pathway. So there needs to be some, as Greg Henry would say, some acceptable miss rate, which, you know, we're still probably missing, despite our the care, we're probably still missing, you know, 1 or 2% of the MIs. You're not going to get that number to zero.
No, and there is no zero in medicine. I mean, if you get a zero, then you're doing too much of something. Yeah. But you even mentioned it already that, you know, even with the increased admissions and increased testing, there's no change or difference in the actual outcomes. Mm-hmm. And that's the important thing that I think we miss in U.S. healthcare is the fact that we so often try to do more and it doesn't pay anything off other than exactly what you mentioned, which is finding incidentalomas and things that we then further amplify that evaluation unnecessarily and put the patients at risk.
Yeah, in some situations, we have too easy access to stuff. Too easy access. Hospitals have MR available. Well, you know, I shouldn't use that example, because to tell you the truth, when you need an MR of the brain or spinal column for an infection or spinal epidural abscess or something like that, you need it. And so I encourage emergency physicians to order the right test. And a lot of times, MR is the right test. And getting a CAT scan is not, yes, it's easier to get, and but it's not the right test. So we're in a tough situation because, you know, when you look at what doctors are trained to do, I think doctors are trained to do a lot of testing. I think it's honestly monkey see, monkey do. The faculty tell them to do a lot of tests. The faculty does a lot of tests. They watch what the faculty does. And there's no incentive not to order tests. You get paid the same. In fact, you may get paid more if you order tests. Based on, you know, now I have an RV that's, level 4 versus a 3 kind of thing. So it would be great if we could create some incentives to be more cost effective. But as far as I know, there aren't any good incentives.
No, this is something you've been working on for a while. I actually pulled up an article from EP Monthly back from November 28th, 2012, that you wrote, Less Art, More Evidence, Challenging Physician Practice Variability. A lot of what you mentioned here, that huge variability you even talked about in that article.
Yeah, I'm a broken record on this.
Well, it's important stuff because it's clearly something that we've made no progress with coming out of the opioid epidemic, finding that the variation in the prescribing of opioids from 7% to 35% of patients and, you know, the numbers are insanely different. There is so much variability, and even looking within my shop, you know, at the different ways we practice medicine, you know, the question is, the reason there's an opportunity for a broken record is because there's still a record. There's still songs to be played on that thing. It's not changing. And in fact, I think in many cases, it's getting worse or more pronounced mm-hmm. with the variability. Where do we go from here in actually addressing this? How do we take somebody who theoretically we're done with training, we're practicing in our various environments, how do we access, evaluate, and then change physician behavior?
Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to measure it in a way that is not going to be assailed by the doctors as methodologically corrupt. Mm-hmm. So you have to do the best you can. I mean, you have to, you know, some people are going to be working nights, some people are not. Those kinds of things have to be considered. So first of all, you measure it. Second of all, you show them the results of the measurement. And you can do it in a blind fashion where, Frank, this is where you are, and you don't get to see where your peers are. You just see where you are on the bell. Mm-hmm. And it's been shown that if you just show people where they are on the bell, that they will move towards more of the center if they're outliers. So that's the first thing you can do. The second thing you do in terms of progressing on this is if that's not working very well, you start to show them names on that graph where they are compared to their colleagues. So it's not just anonymous anymore. And, you know, there's always this issue of carrots and sticks. And to find things that will incentivize physicians to narrow their real variability, because there may be some people on the curve who maybe they don't do enough CAT scans. Although it's hard to show that because you can't say, well, look at the unscheduled returns that this guy gets. Well, that will never work to show them that this doctor is getting a lot of unscheduled returns, and therefore he's not doing enough or she's not doing enough to evaluate these patients, or lawsuits. Certainly that is not a marker of, so there's no measure of person who's doing too little. Complaints, I think that that's a stretch as well. So it's hard to know the at what limit you're not doing enough. It's certainly easy to show you're doing three times more CAT scans than everybody else, Frank, and you got to help us out here. What can you do about it? Well, if the physician says, well, that's just the way I was trained, that I don't really have any great sticks that are, they all relate to money. Mm-hmm. The sticks relate to money or your job. And they're tough to create. So I'm hopeful that most people will say, we want to do this in the best interest of our patients. If we can show that there's this variability, and we can show that there is some data that suggests that this may help us narrow that variability, and that you're all willing to participate in this endeavor, I think that's kind of like a reasonable start. But we got to start, and I think a lot of people, they have no idea what's going on in their departments.
I work in a group, a small little Democratic group, and everything's very, very transparent, and they present all of the data in terms of admission rates, your billing codes, I mean, in terms of your levels that everything is, critical care, everything like that. And you're absolutely right with having that data out there, and we have it associated with the names. I know exactly everything everybody is. I know how much money everybody makes. I know how much reimbursement they get. I know how they bill. I mean, it's the way our group was set up is to be incredibly transparent. But it is interesting because we are narrowing the curve of variability with admission rates and things like that. I mean, people falling on the low end of the critical care kind of pulls up. Those on too high tend to come down. Admission rates tend to be coming in as well. And you can see variation with the patient population, you know, and differences that you see based on, you know, times of the year and things like that. But you're absolutely right. Seeing that data and where you fit on that curve gives you pause for thought to say, what am I doing differently? And because I know with my doctors, I know I trust them and that we're not getting significantly different outcomes. And so if I look at them and say, I'm here, where can we start to change our practice? And we have to do it, because what's going to happen is if we don't evaluate and address this, somebody will do it for us eventually. And we know with rules and legislation, eventually somebody defines your practice for you.
Oh, yeah. I think this data, if at all possible, you need to keep this data between the physicians. You don't want, honestly, the CEO or COO to be seeing this data and saying and looking at these numbers and basically having this needs to be handled internally, I believe. And I think that the good groups are looking at their data, are trying to get better, are trying to be able to show, if ever questioned, here's our data.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that if there's somebody assailing them in some way, you do too many admits or you call too many consults or whatever it is, you can say, you know, this is 20 doctors. You're going to say 20 doctors order too many consults? Come on now.
And you do not want, and you're with that it is important, because you don't want the hospital, your employers making this a metric.
Yeah, and I'm aware of a case right now at one of our local hospitals where the COO basically asked for one of the ER doctors to be taken off the schedule, otherwise known as fired. It's a contract group, and so they're all independent contractors, based on patients per hour. Mm-hmm. And this person was a little bit, somebody's got to be at the low end kind of thing, and this person tended to be at the low end. No complaints about them. And I personally know this doctor, and I've experienced his care, and it was top-notch. But he was being pushed out basically on RVUs and billings and things like that by the COO of the hospital, not by the ER group. And the ER group director has to basically do what the COO says. The ER group works for the COO and the CEO.
We see that way too often. I think that's one of the challenges in medicine now is we have, with the way contracts are formatted, physicians have no due process. It's basically, because I've seen it, the hospital where I worked, right out of residency, my time there, five of the six physicians that were in that group at some point were asked to be off the schedule by the hospital itself for whatever reason, whether it's a complaint from patients, a disagreement with so-and-so, or social media, or whatever it may be. There was always something in that lack of protection. And so we do still have to, we have to look at this stuff, but we also do have to protect our physicians, you know, from this crap that's going on.
No, I agree. And this case is so recent and so powerful in my head because I've not seen that in the past. I was a director of a place for 25 years, and there was one doctor that our CEO basically said we would really prefer that he not work. And I basically made it a case for him for a while so he could continue to work for a while. But, you know, that's out of 25 years. It was one doctor. But this doctor really should not have been picked on for his data. And he was able to, show that here's the reasons why I'm at the lower end for this reason or that. But he never got to make his case before mm-hmm. the COO. The COO was really not interested. COO went to the ER director and said, this guy needs to go.
Unfortunately, it's the easy button. And with a lot of the way the contracts, what they hold over that contract management group is them or your contract.
Exactly. You got to do what we tell you to do.
Yeah. And interestingly, I was looking at the two comments. And, you never should read the comments on anything, but actually the two comments on that article you wrote in 2012 are exactly the arguments you said that folks would make. The variability in practice, the use of tools, variability in practice, and then the malpractice risks associated with the variabilities in practice. And it just doesn't pan out as in the evidence that's there. But I think physicians are often just as gullible at the public and being able to brush off evidence as that's not me, that's not my practice, or that was bad.
Yeah, we are men and women of science, except when we need it to. we don't want the answer from science.
Where are we looking forward? What else? What do we need to do? Because I think we've got to eventually narrow this down somewhat. I mean, there's not going to be one answer. There's a doctor with me in Lexington, Kentucky versus California. There will be some variability, but for the most part, it should still be a relatively narrow curve, a bell curve. And so how are we going to, moving forward, how do we pull that in and pull that together?
I think it's really tough because it requires the physicians to be willing to change. And they feel we're crossing into areas that they are no longer comfortable with in terms of their behavior. And when a doctor's been out for 5, 10, 15 years, getting them to change their practice is really, really, really tough. And yet, my example was one doctor admits 38% of his pneumonia patients, another 78. I mean, I could show you example after example after example of what I would view as egregious variability, and it's like, well, so what? And I think somebody needs to kind of say, this is not right. Our patients are not getting the best care we can deliver. Now, people say, well, how do you know what the right answer is? Should we be admitting 78% of the pneumonia cases? Is that the right answer? Well, this study basically said there was no difference in outcome or severity of illness in these cases. And so it's like, how many is the right number of CTs to get? Well, if you've got somebody who's done, the PCARN rules, as an example, were based on 30, 40,000 kids. I mean, validated over and over again. And if you can follow those and say, guys, why don't we just follow the PCARN rules and let them be our guide to who gets CTs? And sure, there's going to be some variability, and there's going to be some cases where we're going to get a CT anyway. But if we can say, I follow the rules, here they are, they've been validated, and I decided based on the rules and my exam and a kid that we didn't need to do it, and mom said, well, I really want a CAT scan, then we need to feel comfortable saying, well, based on our examination evaluation, your son will, or daughter will be getting a radiation that they really don't need. Mm-hmm. And to be very candid, if my child had the same injury, I would not get a CAT scan. You can't go to the mat in these cases when they want something done. But if you feel comfortable with the process by which you've made this decision, then you ought to try to follow the rules, follow the PIPED rules for PE. We're just rule averse. Nobody follows the Ottawa ACL rules here in the States.
No, we always talk, and that was exactly the rule I was thinking of, was we always talk ourselves out of a rule that is very well verified.
Yeah.
Then, walking in there, and docs don't want to have those
discussions. Yeah, but I've been waiting here in this ER for now 2 hours, and you're going to tell me I don't need that. Look at my ankle. Come on there, doctor.
It's big and painful. It's got to be broken. It hurts.
No, it's like, I earned this x-ray, damn it.
The number of times I've heard that, I deserve it, I've earned it, my Medicaid, Medicare pays for it, whether it's a pillow, whether it's a Sprite, whether it's Chesta, whatever it is.
Or Tylenol.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned in this article right here, the CT scanning for atraumatic headaches, ranging from 15.2% to 61.7%. And you mentioned there's going to be examples everywhere of this huge variability with no outcome changes.
Yeah, I'd get off my soapbox on this if we weren't talking about such egregious numbers. Numbers that actually nobody knows about. But if you start looking at the literature, in the Emergency Medical Abstract Database, we have we've probably done at least 15,000 abstracts since we started this thing. There's 170 that have the word variability in their title. And do you think those articles talk about lack of variability? They're all about variability, and yet there's such inertia in this regard. It seems to be evidence proof, data proof.
Sitting here with Dr. Rick Mikata, how can folks get in touch with you if they have any questions, thoughts, or maybe some young, excited physician who wants to tackle this thing?
Well, I love people to contact me. My email address is wrbukata, BUKATA@gmail.com. I know that my position is not the popular position here. I know that I'm going to be assailed because you don't understand. But frankly, I do understand. And but I'm open to what you have to say.
WRBukata@gmail.com. I appreciate the time. I hope we can make this a regular sit down. I've been listening to you guys for years and glad to finally have you here on the front line.
I'd welcome the opportunity. Thanks so much, Ryan.
All right, as for me, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, @everydaymed on Twitter. And until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASAP Frontline.